from WXXI News. This is a summer of food on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made on your local farms and maybe on your dining room table. The Summer of Food explores the local food system today with a guy who created something to tie the local system together in a sustainable way. Chris Hartman is the founder of Headwater Food Hub, and he came to this project with a number of ideas, including this one. People want, and frankly people need, to be able to make good food choices more easily. That means at work, at home, for their kids, in their schools. What exactly, by the way, is a food hub? In this case, it's a network of small farmers tied together by one professional partner. And if Headwater is successful, it means food becomes easy to track to its source, reliable, clean, and healthy, the economic impact easy to see and tangibly feel, among other things. So do you know your farmer? Do you feel like you got a good grasp of the local food system? My guest for the hour is the founder and president of Headwater Food Hub. Chris, welcome back to the program. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you, Evan.
I took you out of your day, and you're often on the road kind of bouncing around to different parts of Western New York and upstate, you know, meeting with farmers. And where are you going today, by the way? Can you tell us?
Well, my role is actually a really wonderful part of my experience at Headwater these days. I do a lot to really work closely with the farmers to coordinate the various projects we're working on at Headwater and the ways in which their goals as farmers and their hopes and desires for the year, both the specifics of crops they're trying to grow and the more general the farmers they're trying to be. You know, I get to really sit down and have those conversations and do a lot of the planning in a kind of collective success type of mentality. I was down actually in the Finger Lakes region earlier this morning, meeting with a few of our farmers that are raising eggs and pigs, and just sort of further coordinating all of the moving parts that go into those farmers beautifully raising those animals getting into processing facilities, those beautiful meat products ending up with us, and then eventually our customers. So getting a chance to do that, and then this afternoon I'll be sitting down with a variety of chefs that you know, are coordinating their menus and thinking about the various ways in which they're trying to make food choices. So I get the wonderful experience of really getting to jump into that side of things as well.
And so there's a lot of parts that come together that we're going to be talking about this hour. But what I want to do is go back and do a little bit of history on how we got here, because Chris started back, Headwater started in 2009, but it did not start at the level that it is today. It took some time. What was the vision? Why did you decide to create Headwater?
Well, actually, the real beginning, I would argue, of Headwater Food Hub started when Vicky and I, my wife, and a variety of folks in the community got together and organized and started the South Wedge Farmers Market. And that was a few years prior to launching Headwater Food Hub. And really, the mission and vision of the farmers market had a very similar feel as far as what we're trying to do at Headwater, really looking to connect with small and mid-sized farmers, really trying to understand both organic and biodynamic and sustainable-oriented farmers and where they were at and what markets they were able to access, and really trying to put a project together that gave them much broader access to markets and much more viable business opportunities as far as really running their farms and expanding their operations if they so desired. So South Wedge Farmers Market began as one of Rochester's first producer-only markets and really had a strong organic and sustainable farmer.
How did
approach.
That go, by the way, right out of the gate? How did it go?
Right out of the gate, it went fantastic. There was undeniably a real desire and need to have that type of access, to have a place in which you could know and trust the farmers that were there. Mind you, lots of other great projects going in and around Rochester, lots of great aspects of the public market and many of the other markets around. But the producer-only commitment and really the chance to have that many at the time, that many organic and sustainable-oriented farmers all in the same place selling their goods was a really unique opportunity that a lot of people were excited about. But when we started that farmers market, we really had a big and broad vision from the get-go as far as really in a collaborative way being part of making change in the food system, creating positive change in what for many people I know feels like a pretty negative, pretty I want to even say dangerous, but almost embarrassing sort of industrial American food system that, you know, we so often have to rely on. So really looking for alternatives and really wanting to create create models that could be part of the future of food. And, you know, as we got into that project and being energetic and enthusiastic about it all, really thinking about that project and the specific details of running that well, but thinking about the larger context in which it's operating. And despite its out-of-the-gate excitement and the great things that many farmers markets are, you know, they remain sort of a small piece of a very large food system. And from, you know, early on in the farmers market, ourselves and many of the farmers participating in would spend a lot of time after markets and hanging out talking about, okay, this is, you know, this is good, but what else and what next and how do we potentially start to make more significant impacts? And that really was the birth of Headwater Food Hub and where we've gotten.
You used a word that I agreed with, and it brought to mind some ideas for me, but I want to ask you more about what you meant. When you said, when you look at the broader food system, sometimes it even feels embarrassing. I agree, but I want to hear you explain why that word came to your mind.
Yeah, and I was trying to think rapidly of my word choices.
Sure. Because I think that's a good one.
Yeah, well,
I do.
I don't mean to say that either in the sense that, or I do, I meant to say that, but I don't mean to imply that there aren't wonderful, well-intentioned, very intelligent people involved in all sorts of aspects of our current food system. I really do like to think from the kind of systems level and not attempt to personalize any of this in too significant
Absolutely.
Of a way.
Understand.
So when I say embarrassing, I'm not trying to judge others and the roles they're playing in there. But from that systems level view, when you look at the food system we have created as a country and how, and on a very scientific level, we are generating calories to sustain our life, it is flat out embarrassing on a variety of different levels. You could look at it again from that scientific level, and again, I'm not sure what the current calculation generates, but you know, the 19 calories of energy it takes us to put into the food system to get one calorie out would be one layer of embarrassment. Embarrassment and inefficiencies and sort of a challenging way in which to sustain ongoing food production. You could look at it in the environmental perspective and the sort of degradation and damage we do to the ecosystem and the environment in which food is produced, and there too is a very embarrassing approach. You could look on it from the humane treatment of animals perspective. And
that's the first thing I thought of.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's, by the way, there's embarrassment could swap out with anger, frustration, sadness, horror, maybe even in some examples. But yeah, the industrialized meat system is a problematic, to use the best word I can think of right now, problematic approach to really feeding ourselves. And the social aspect, the labor piece of farming and agriculture, who has access to what type of food, what food is subsidized in what ways, there's just a lot of really the first word that comes to mind, a lot of embarrassing aspects to how we've set things up. And in a positive way, a lot of really exciting opportunities of how we can rethink and re-envision how we're doing that. And that really has been the focus of Headwater from the beginning. What could the future of food look like? How would it prioritize social and environmental justice aspects? And how would it move out of a boutique, or how would that aspect of a food system move out of the boutique high-end aspect and really be a significant part of how food is produced and consumed in communities.
And so you start working with farmers, and Headwater, I guess, officially launches in 2009. Small, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, the first 2 years, it really just piggybacked on the farmers market. Really, actually, for us, the Food Hub, the name Food Hub, is undeniably a more current buzzword in the regional sustainable food system development world. Food hubs in general are really interesting and innovative models that are, again, in the way the word sounds, trying to connect small and mid-sized farmers in a collective, collaborative way and move that volume and quality of food out into the community in significant ways. Before that was a term, before that was a concept, we were running the South Wedge Farmers Market, and in a very physical, in front of you way, we had 20 farmers drive into the same parking lot on a weekly basis, bringing in all the food that they wanted to sell at the market, often having excess or certainly truck room to bring more, and then driving all back to their farm. So for us, it became that very specific aha moment of like, wait a minute, what an asset to build on here. We've got 20 farmers all driving into the city for this market. How can we fill their trucks? What would we do with that food? And how could we get it to more people than just show up at the market? So that was sort of that classic entrepreneurial, innovative kickoff. And what was the first year? We either bought a pop-up tent or a tarp that I bungeed on the back of a truck we were using, and we literally just sort of aggregated the food there at the market in the parking lot. I was a carpenter in and around that time, so I took my old tool trailer, insulated it, put a air conditioner window unit in there and rewired it to run at 40 degrees, and we would put all the food in that, and then the next morning, we would drive around the community delivering that food to the customer base we had built. And that was not even a part-time job. That was around the full-time job that I had and around the running of the market. And it was just, could we experiment with something and see if there's some way we could build this out?
Now, by the way, we're talking to Chris Hartman, who is the founder and president of Headwater Food Hub. Some of our listeners are going, wait a second, he's describing the Good Food Collective.
Yeah.
And you're sort of right, but why don't you explain?
Well, yeah, no, they are right in the sense that that very beginning was indeed the Good Food Collective. That was the first and has been one of the foremost projects that Headwater has been working on. We did incorporate as Headwater Food Hub at that moment, but our first project and how we were known in the community and how we often continue to be known is the folks behind the Good Food Collective. And that really was, as I just described, the launch of what we were doing sort of out of the farmers market. How could we take the farmers market, learn a lot from the beautiful CSA models that are in operation around here and elsewhere, and come up with some sort of innovative new approach to really push that type of thing out to a lot more people in a lot more ways, and in a similar way, make that model very accessible to a lot more farmers. So that really was our start and to some degree our sole focus for many years in the beginning.
Okay, and Good Food has, for the folks who know it, of course it has grown and thrived. Headwater, though, did you know early on, this may grow slowly, but there is a ceiling. In other words, we're not going to be an industrial, we're not going into the CAFO world, we're not going into the big industrial world. Is there a ceiling for how big you can get? And are you approaching anything like that? You know, tell me about that.
Yeah, great question. And I love this conversation in a lot of ways. And I do put this at the heart of some of the important thing, not just we are trying to do at Headwater, but communities are doing, and we should all be more actively engaged in what is an appropriate scale and how are we measuring that and understanding that and where do we see that. There is no doubt, Headwater is in a purposeful gray area and willing to be so as far as what are some of the experimental boots on the ground ways we can understand that question in much more dynamic and intelligent ways. The aspect of the organic local food system, one of the problematic natures has been its small scale nature, and whether it's the cost of production issues that arises or the general accessibility of that or even the sort of surrounding research and investment and business growth. Without all of that, it becomes again this sort of occasionally problematic higher end option for the people who have means to choose so. And then of course you have the flip side aspect of huge scaled farming operations that have for a variety of reasons, and we can talk about policy in a second, but for a variety of reasons have gotten to a scale and worked towards incredibly inexpensive food per this commodity business realm that food has entered. And that has huge problematic aspects, both in its scale and on a variety of levels, as we've talked about. So where is the sweet spot in between? What is an appropriate scale, then how would one start to understand that? That's, like I said, that's a conversation we are endlessly having and something we're really interested in. You mentioned the Good Food Collective thriving. I agree with that very much in the sense that it is a very energetic, very enthusiastic, very beautiful program that, connects families and individuals to an unbelievable selection of food coming off of local organic farmers' land and other farmers as well, besides just certified organic, but a really beautiful family of farmers contributing to this program, and it's a beautiful beautiful pile of food that, you know, that ends up in people's homes. That is thriving for me on many levels. It is still, however, an experimental project that is, you know, this is not a giant profitable business, huge scale sort of thing in that realm. This is a, can we make this work, a planning with farmers kind of concept, and a still, I would argue, bootstrapping experiment to really, with farmers and consumers, try and figure out what makes sense for all of us. What could be a really convenient but values-driven, affordable way in which food could be produced surrounding this community and accessible to people within it? It is thriving and all of those beautiful ways, but again, is in that experimental category of how do we really understand farmers and consumers' perspectives in in-depth, intelligent ways to really put the pieces together on a project that works well. The Headwater programs outside of the Good Food Collective have their own version of a very similar story as far as appropriate scale and how that works. So this jumps a little bit forward in our story to some degree from where we began at the farmers market, but we have had a strong focus on the wholesale realm and really looking at farm to school, farm to institution, and farm to general big food purchasers, and really trying to wrap our heads around how can that be done in appropriately scaled ways, and what do we see that looking like? So, for example, you know, one of the things we did as an outcome to a feasibility study we did 2 years ago was begin to develop some internal processing capacity to chop and wash salad greens. And that project was very much focused around identifying opportunities as far as what farmers were growing or able to grow and were seeking additional markets for, as well as what buyers and purchasers within organizations really were using a lot of and seeking local options for. You know, in getting involved in that project, it has been fascinating to me to think exactly about this question, appropriate scale. Prior to our involvement in this, one of the very few options any institutional buyer in this area would have to put chopped and washed romaine in their salad bar, which is what most institutions and schools do, is sourcing from what I like to call the industrial salad complex out in California, Taylor Farms specifically, which is a huge corporation, you know, internationally owned and doing all sorts of bizarre, interesting, problematic things as far as how it runs its business and how it works with growers. And really, that's your option. Huge scale, hugely problematic, again, on a variety of the layers we've discussed. Our attempt to establish a regional processing facility within New York State to supply not only the University of Rochester, one of our favorite partners, and St. John Fisher as well, but potentially the SUNY school system throughout New York, that could easily be viewed from some audience as, oh boy, they're getting huge. Here we go again. It's lost its values and they're just in this for the money. That is not a fair or correct approach or view on it, obviously, in my opinion. I see a Northeast processing center that was working with a significant amount of farmers and distributing organic, chopped and washed, locally grown, locally processed lettuce throughout New York State as a very appropriately scaled operation that is part of the future of food as far as a country, us really putting together strategies that can have positive impact.
You talked about Taylor and how you feel that when it comes to the relationships they have with their producers, you used the word problematic again. How do you protect your producers and farmers? How do you make sure they're getting a good deal in this?
Great question. I think, again, like so many things at Headwater, this is an evolving process as we really are willing to be active learners and responsive to what we're seeing, doing, and hearing. Working with farmers, obviously, from the beginning in the starting of the farmers market has been a fully ingrained aspect of how we do business. This is, when we say soil to table, we're not just talking about the food being picked from somebody else's, you know, fields and we deliver it to a table. We're talking about sitting down with the farmers in their homes. We're talking about walking the fields as crops are growing, and we're talking about the coordination of farmers, their production and harvest schedules, and their fair price and cost of production, you know, concepts, and really getting together through dialogue and relationship and trust to a shared understanding of how this is going to mutually benefit each other and how we're going to sort of move forward. So to me, one of the things we talk a lot about as far as what we are trying to do that is different or what is unique about our project, We think of ourselves as focusing on a business that is nested within relationship. So relationship with our farmers that really has open communication, honesty, and a sense of trust. That doesn't mean we always agree, and that doesn't mean we're always happy with what each other are doing, but the ability to talk, listen, understand, and move forward accordingly. And then in a similar way, trust with our customers and who's receiving this food and really being able to stand by, is this perfect? No, not always. Are we really trying together with you and our farmers to make sense of how it eventually could be? Absolutely, and we really want your trust accordingly. And as I continue to learn, there's a whole lot of people in between those farmers and people that we work with in increasingly interesting ways. And how do we really find collaborators and partners that have a shared sense of value and can really work similarly within relationship like that?
Talking to Chris Hartman, the founder and president of Headwater Food Hub. Online where, Chris?
We've got headwaterfoodhub.com, and then again, very relevant for many people as far as how we're known and active in the community, thegoodfoodcollective.com.
I'm a graduate of the Good Food Collective, and let me just say that I think Good Food Collective is sort of the gateway drug to connecting to local farms. Sometimes people start with Good Food Collective, sometimes through their work, sometimes at home, and they start thinking more about where things are coming from. They meet people more, sometimes they meet a farmer directly for the first time. And then maybe eventually they say, well, I'm going to actually join a CSA through one of those farms. I've seen it as kind of a gateway drug, but here's why I asked about protecting farmers. I also think about, this is going to sound strange, but I'm thinking about coffee, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking about so-called third wave coffee, which isn't just being able to draw pretty art in the foam on your espresso. Mm-hmm. Though I always like to challenge the folks over at Ugly Duck Coffee, can you draw like a clown holding the world or something? You know, not just a heart. But it's about knowing that hopefully where that coffee was grown, the people who are growing it are not being treated poorly by corporations anymore. They have a relationship that they're being treated well, that they're being compensated fairly, that matters, and that I care about that. I feel the same way when I think about Headwater and I think about what you're doing. I want to know that those farmers are, like you said, I mean, there's going to be relationships, there's going to be push-pull, but I want to know that I'm willing to spend a little bit more, but I want to know that they're being sort of put first. And it sounds like that ethos is going to stay as part of Headwater.
Yeah, no, that is a founding principle and an often overwhelming challenge and on many levels that we are absolutely committed to, and I would argue making great progress on. Really understanding how to prioritize farmers. When I say challenge, I don't mean we're challenged by wanting to prioritize farmers' needs. Really understanding that well across the now 70 different farmers that we work with, and really with them kind of co-forming how that aligns with the activities at Headwater Food Hub and where we see real market opportunity and where we think this can benefit them. That again, it takes a lot of communication and it takes a lot of dialogue and it takes time as we grow and learn together. But our desire to prioritize fair prices to farmers and the reality of farming as a more important and driving force to what's being consumed in communities, that is our commitment in a nutshell.
And so how big are you now? How many people work for Headwater?
We've got about, I believe, 14 year-round, really amazing, very talented, energetic people working at Headwater. And then, you know, as one can imagine with the local food as it is, we have a lot of help that joins us from sort of June through the end of November to really help with the significant amount of vegetables moving through the food hub during those times.
When it comes to what you are doing, you used lettuce as just one example, romaine lettuce, where that's going to be found at colleges, workplaces, grocery stores, and that California's big industrial lettuce is really where it comes from. So that's true here, and that has been true in Western New York. That's probably also true in Florida, or that's probably also true in Maine. Are there regional food hubs like Headwater in other places? Are you learning from them? Is this sort of a values movement that you have brothers and sisters across the country on?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's actually one of the most exciting things that that this can be part of. We have a wonderful community of food hubs sort of emerging in and around the country. We have a variety of organizations that do, you know, various aspects of bringing us together to help share best practices, whether it's conference or visiting various food hubs or webinars. A lot of really, as many people know, whether it's organic farmers running their own CSA or organizations that are running food hubs or any number of other projects, there's a really wonderful community of people that are actively thinking about creating positive change in the food system. And as I mentioned, food hubs have really been a center of innovation right now around how to really help the small, mid-size, appropriate scaled farmers be a more robust contribution to the marketplace of food. So the Wallace Center, for example, a funding not-for-profit organization that has food hubs very much on their radar as far as interesting emerging concepts to watch and support, runs a conference every other year in different parts of the country for maybe 8 or so years now. And we went to the very first one, actually presented just as we had launched the food hub and the wholesale side of it. And the crowd then was maybe 50 to 80 people. And at this point, it's just a huge 3-day conference with thousands of people attending and a lot of energy around the business model and infrastructure and capacity associated with emerging and developing food hubs and how they are working or not. Again, there's a lot of experimentation, and like any good learning, there's things that work and things that don't work. We know that well at Headwater as well. But a lot of people working hard to understand these things, and a really communicative, sharing community around what's working where and how do we support one another.
All right, one more question before our only break of the hour. And we're talking about the local food system and Headwater's place in it with Chris Hartman, the founder and president of Headwater Food Hub, here on the Summer of Food on Connections. And we'll take some of your phone calls in our second half hour. I see the phone ringing, but let me just ask you one more quick question, because you brought up policy, and that could be its own probably week of conversation, food policy, ag policy, but also food as commodity, the way it's treated. And this is a very complex question, so I will ask you to give me sort of, what's the low-hanging fruit on ag policy in this country that you think would really make positive change for everybody involved in the system?
There's obviously people way smarter than I am and way more involved in this issue. So I don't want to speak too in depth on it all, because it is not my area of expertise. But I will say, I'm never too sure in our desire to be part of change. I'm never too sure if this boots on the ground, let's create something that is an experiment and a model of the future of food, if that's our best approach, or if we should all be down in Washington with our fists in the air and getting change. Because it really does feel like you're up against impossible odds with the way we've structured policy. And my low-hanging fruit would be the subsidy structure. And as a society, or as a government, or as policymakers, what we have chosen to support and subsidize as far as what farmers are producing and growing, and what we have left to just hope that there's a market force that drives it forward. There's a lot of, again, embarrassing aspects to how that unfolds and what foods it makes available, and why a 2-liter bottle of Coke, for example, is 99 cents and a quart of heirloom local tomatoes is $5 or $6. There's nothing inherently cheap about producing Coke. It's a really complex, really complicated, crazy concoction of things. But because of what we've chose to subsidize and because of what we've chose to make cheap, I'm going to say, affordable, inexpensive, it is that. It is a cheap product on the shelf, and the heirloom tomatoes.
And because of that policy, most people think of, quote, Coke is cheap. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what you're saying is Coke is a product that becomes cheap because of policy and values choices that we are setting, not because it is inherently cheaper than other food products create.
Yeah, I you know, there's obviously a cheapness associated with the scale that they've
achieved. Well, sure, volume.
But the policy would drive that ability to get to that scale, and then it just snowballs, and it's inexpensive. Yeah, that's a policy choice that we've made, not specifically to, hey, we want Coke to be cheap, but in subsidizing corn in the way that we have specifically in that example, the outcome of that is what we see, a highly processed, very inexpensive plethora of foods in most grocery stores and food access points.
Let's get our only break of the hour. We'll come back to some of your phone calls. Wade at St. John Fisher College will come to you when we come back.
Right.
And see the phone ringing again. Chris Hartman is the founder and president of Headwater Food Hub. The second hour of every Thursday this summer is the Summer of Food, a different conversation on trends, what's going on in the industry, agriculture, policy, fine dining, garbage plates, food identity, and more. And we'll continue with Chris when we come back. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, President Trump told The Wall Street Journal that people in upstate New York, well, the economy is so bad, they should just go to another state where the jobs are. And if they have house payments, they should just walk away from their houses, leave those behind. We'll talk to people in local economic development about the impact of those comments and how they see the jobs picture. Then second hour, our first of several interviews with candidates for Rochester School Board. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and let's grab a couple of phone calls. Wade at St. John Fisher College calling, who, Chris, I think you know Wade well, is that right?
I do indeed. Yeah, he's one of our favorite customers.
Hi, Wade, go ahead.
How are you today?
Very good.
We have, at St. John Fisher, been using Headwater for quite a few years now, and it has made, you know, before they were around, I tried to find farmers, and, you know, I'd have to individually create relationships with each of them, which is a wonderful thing, but is not the most efficient way of getting lots of produce. So when these guys came around with their model, it has been spectacular. You know, we tasked them with finding 300 dozen local cage-free eggs a week to deliver to us, and they were able to come through. It has made getting local things just so much easier from our end.
Wade, how long you been using Headwater?
It seems like forever, but probably 6 or 7 years. Before they even had their wholesale, you know, we would buy surplus from the Good Food Collective. You know, I've known Chris and some of the other guys for a long time, and they would say, hey, we have extra of this stuff, and, you know, literally just picking and buying it out of the back of a truck. And to see them grow to this point where I can order online is wonderful. Wonderful.
Anything you want to add before we let Wade go?
Yeah, I mean, I think Wade's a great example of the many different pieces and players that need to be at the table to make this all work. You know, on one level, first and foremost, Wade's a chef and is passionate about food and knows good food. And, you know, that is a fundamentally important part often we find of good fit customer relationships. But the other beautiful thing is Wade's working within an organization like St. John Fisher that has chosen to really prioritize understanding their role within a food system and attempting to make, as best as one can, good choices about what food is coming into their kitchens and where their food dollars are going. So it's a real sweet spot where we can work with somebody like Wade, who's not only a fantastic person, but like I said, a really wonderful chef and passionate about food. And we can work with him within an organization that wants to be part on the buying side of helping to create change and new models as well.
Hey, Wade, can I ask you a question before we let you go?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so you talked about the benefits that you see Headwater bringing in, and one of the things that Chris was talking about was, you know, comparing, you know, sort of big industrial. He chose lettuce as an example. There's lots of examples that we could have used for that whether it's restaurants, universities, whatever, they're using the big industrial example. You care about this, but I wonder, you know, your counterparts in other universities and other places and other organizations, I guess I would ask you both, and I'll start with you, Wade, do enough people care? Or do people think, look, lettuce is lettuce, give me the cheapest. You know, whatever the food product is, give me the cheapest. Do you think we are moving in a direction where more of us care about that?
I think we are. It is, you know, from a financial aspect, it can be challenging at times because, as you know, Chris was pointing out, it doesn't always make sense what's cheaper. I can get comparably priced lettuce from California, you know, shipped here, and it's, you know, sometimes it's even cheaper, but it's not the example we want to set for the students. You know, we try to educate them on where the food comes from, and when you show them the other option from the giant industrial farm, it's a wonderful thing. You know, we do go through lots of product here. So, you know, as we move from things we get from the national distributors to the things we get from Headwater, you know, we need to do it incrementally. It wouldn't have been fair to anyone to say, oh, we're going to get everything all at once from you guys right off the bat, and that throws off their flow. But when it's things like, you know, they found us, the egg people, we've been working with them with some local ground beef things. It's sometimes you have to make some adjustments other places to accommodate some of the greater expenses on a smaller scale system like this. But, you know, it's the choice we've made, and we want to do it that way rather than, you know, the cheaper, easier way sometimes.
Wade, thank you for the phone call. Appreciate that. I know Chris does as well. And Chris, why don't you follow up to some of what Wade just had to say there. Do you think enough people are caring about this issue to kind of keep Headwater moving and growing and connecting?
We hope so.
I guess that the answer to that question will determine how long Headwater's around, maybe.
Yeah, no, you know, there's no doubt we are in that experimental, as I keep saying, phase, really trying to understand what is a viable business within the future of food we want to see. You know, Wade is a great example on that level he describes as well. This does take time. We've spent a few years in conversation with them and U of R, again, as a great partner as well, kind of problem solving and collectively thinking about how this can work. And it's slow and steady. You know, as a business, the entrepreneurial side and business development side of Headwater, you know, that could be a whole nother show unto itself. You know, people think, within the scale of often thought of local and organic projects, think of us as huge and grow, and I forget even the adjective you used before, and just assume that, oh man, what a successful company, and they're making so much money. We are still an experiment that's trying to figure out if there's a profitable future in the kind of model that we're trying to create, and we know and believe there is, and are in that nimble, active learning phase of trying to move in that direction. But we need the community to kind of grow along with us in that way. And we need, just like you described to that question, we need people to continue to prioritize making good choices. We need families and individuals signing up for CSAs like you have done. We need them going to local farmers markets, and we need them joining the Good Food Collective if that's a good fit for them as well. And then we need colleges and universities and restaurants and nursing homes and hospitals to really start to think about and prioritize good food choices. And if we can all move in that direction together, we know there's a great opportunity for small and mid-sized organic farmers in this realm, and we know there's a future for Headwater that again has chosen not the not-for-profit philanthropically supported structure, but has chosen to try and figure out a business model that can make sense in this realm. And this isn't a get-rich concept, but this is, how do you create an economically viable company that pays its workers workers well, that treats farmers well and pays fair prices, and offers a great food choice at affordable prices to individuals, to restaurants, to institutions, whatever it might be. And, you know, it's an experiment. The jury's out. We're hoping everybody's along for the ride. We feel very optimistic about where we're going, but we're always scratching our head trying to figure out if this is going to work or not.
Well, on those lines, before we grab Tony from the University of Rochester, who I know also works with you, and we'll talk to Tony in a second, but a couple quick questions to follow that. Who are your newest clients? Who's recently called you that said, hey, that's great. It's great to get a call from someone like that. Yeah, we can definitely work with you.
Well, we've got incoming calls for sure that reach out to us. We've also, obviously, as you can imagine, we've got a lot of great folks at Headwater, Phil Bianchi and the whole team over there that is reaching out to potential customers and really trying to get the chance to tell them about our story, what we're doing, and what we have to offer.
So ideally, eventually, they'll come to you, but you're still doing a lot of hand selling.
We're still trying to reach out, but we absolutely get calls, particularly as we make progress in really being a great supply chain partner to colleges and universities who really do want to make these choices and to their privilege have a little bit more budget room than your average K-12 setting, which is something we're also focused on, but is very challenging in a different way. The more that they're looking to do this, the more pressure that students and sometimes administration is pushing on kitchens to make these choices, we start to look like a very attractive partner because that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to provide the high quality, sustainably grown, but available in volume consistently with increasing food safety compliance issues associated with it. We're trying to nail all that and be able to deliver it to colleges. So places like Cornell we're actively talking with right now, and because of their ag focus and history, because of their location, it's a great example of a new conversation that we're thrilled to be having. And we talk a lot with the SUNY system because of good policy choices within New York State, they have strong incentives to be procuring locally. We're not at the scale to be really servicing SUNYs broadly, but we are starting to work with some of our local SUNY schools, and those are conversations we're really excited about. But every day we talk to an individual or a family about the Good Food Collective and what we're trying to do with our network of farms, and we talk a lot with parents about the food choices they're trying to make for their kids, and we talk a lot with all sorts of people, farmers included, and we look forward to every one of those conversations.
You believe that people want to make good choices, and maybe policy has made it easier to make quote-unquote cheaper or bad choices or lesser choices, but the idea that people wouldn't change is sort of baloney, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's I want them to be able to make good choices. I want them to be able to make good choices easily. And I want them to be able to go to work and not have to bring the doggy bag with them if they think that's the only way they'll be able to make a good choice. And I want kids to be able to go to school and not have parents wondering about what the heck are they eating right now. All those things.
All right, Tony from the University of Rochester. Go ahead, Tony.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hi there.
So building off of what Wade said, we've been partnering with Crits for a very long time as well. I mean, I remember where we started with just some frozen IQF vegetables from the Hudson Valley to what they have in place now. And just building off of, you know, do the customers really want or care where the stuff comes from? Not everybody does, but I think especially with Headwater, to be able to put a face on not only the Headwater team, but just the farmers. Where's the food coming from? And having a family, you know, seeing their picture of the family where your romaine lettuce comes from or your tomatoes or your squash, I think generates, with a lot of students, again, not everybody, but being able to really say, hey, did you know your food's coming from 20 miles down the road and it's not traveling all the way from the West Coast? It really resonates not only from, you know, safe food and sustainability, but really, you know, great quality food. And you know, the big picture too is Rochester. How do we build Rochester and in the surrounding counties and keep things within New York State? And I think that mission Headwater has been driving, and you know, Fisher, University of Rochester, really the power of this area and keeping things within for a full season and utilizing everything to its fullest is a challenge for chefs, but I'm sure a challenge for Headwater. But really keeping things within and generating quality without your food coming all the way, you know, halfway across the country. So it's been a great partnership, and You know, I look for, we have some great things with the chopped greens and exciting stuff with New York State beef. It's great to see, and it's fun to kind of create these new things every year and see them build from what they started from. It's been great.
Yeah, and I just add to that in the sense that Tony is, again, just another fantastic example. And U of R is to be commended from my perspective as far as they're really, really trying to figure this out and really trying to prioritize making good choices with their food dollars. And U of R is a great example of, like, this is about economic development in a lot of ways. There is a huge amount of money that we spend as a community on food. You know, depending on the data that you look at, the greater Rochester area spends about $500 million a year on food. Right now, 1-3% of that is sort of captured by local production potential.
How much?
About $500 million.
And how much is captured?
1-3%. Again, nobody's actively researched that in our area, so we're looking at some aggregate data there. But we believe strongly at Headwater, and we know U of R believes well because they are driving this with their purchase power, that without a significant amount of investment or innovation or building new capacity, but just by making smarter choices and engaging in the problem-solving aspect of doing something new, we could easily be sourcing 10% of our food from local production sources, reinvesting $50 million on an annual basis into our community. That is a huge economic development strategy in a very lasting, durable, enjoyable way. We believe at Headwater, and we know U of R believes as well, with some innovation and investment, we could easily be doing 30-50% of our purchasing locally. Just huge amount of money is being reinvested into businesses. And again, that whole economic development aspect is a whole nother show unto itself, in the sense that this really does have an active audience in that arena. But the U of R, I bring that up just because I've loved watching their commitment to this, and it does come down to very specific dollar and cents data gathering. They have set a goal to spend a certain percentage of their food dollars on local options. I commend them on that level alone, and then I commend them on the success they have had marching that percentage up and up and meeting those goals. So Tony and his team over there have been great examples, again, of the sort of collaborative work that this needs to be, understanding and experimenting with all of the different foods we can and should be getting from local farms. And he mentioned the beef project. I see this as a huge example of some of the things we can put together when we're sharing, talking, and working together within relationship over time.
Tony, thanks for the phone call. Great addition to the program. I'm going to try to work in a couple more listener questions and comments. John in Rochester, got to keep it tight. Go ahead, John.
Hi. I was just... correct me if I'm wrong here. Headwater is a third party that connects customers with farmers?
It depends on how you mean by connect, but yeah. We don't, you know, there's a variety of approaches and strategies within the food hub world. Some quite literally are sort of an asset list, never touch the food, connect farmers and consumers. We buy product directly from farmers, take it into our food hub, and then sell it out into the community. But in that way, yeah, we connect individuals and businesses to local farms.
Okay. Do you have any plans of bringing blockchain technology to that sort of business structure?
Blockchain technology.
Yeah, it's known most widely right now as Bitcoin, but the technology behind Bitcoin is much more in depth, and it would work perfectly for what you're doing in terms of connecting an individual with a farmer.
Huh.
Because its initial principle is to do away with third-party trusted entities.
Yeah.
So that the customer is actually interacting directly with the farmer instead of with an entity which could get corrupted, do all these other things.
Yeah.
John, thank you for that. Sounds like it's new to your radar there.
Yeah, I'm not familiar, although always interested in some of the new emerging things. What I will say is, you know, our attempts to play a role between farmers and consumers is quite purposeful, and we understand well the kind of problematic and corruptible nature of the middle person that it exists, but we are proudly trying to redefine that and look at that, and it's from both sides. I can't tell you how many farmers I work with that are not interested in the many consumers or many restaurants calling them and ordering and having to deliver all that. This is a service to protect our farmers sometimes as much as it is to support them. So, but that's not true for all farmers, and there's many good fits and many good models and many direct relationships that are beautiful approaches to how we do this. But we're very purposely focused on the two between farm to table type projects and really trying to do that well.
All right, one more quick question. It comes an email from Philip, and he says, I belong to a CSA. I'll pay more when the product is clearly better, but why should I pay twice as much for rye bread that's sold at a farmer's market versus that sold at Wegmans, both made fresh? What's wrong with fresh produce at Wegmans when it's cheaper than at the aforementioned market? And to me, just as good. Competition, as reflected in price, matters.
Yeah, you know, I think that's there's a valid opinion in there, and I actually am pretty often impressed with the work Wegmans has done to really build out their values-oriented supply chain, which indeed has a really robust local offering. You know, Wegmans, the scale that Wegmans is and the retail environment in general is a real challenge for small and mid-sized farmers. It's what they're doing and the farms they've worked with is impressive, and I know it's a win-win and the ones that continue to work, but it's not a great marketplace for all farmers, and it's not an easy retail environment in which to sell food into. And as far as the bread and you know, Wegmans being a wonderful bakery operation and hiring really talented people who are making great bread, that is totally true, and I've had some fantastic breads from there. For me, I enjoy also supporting the small independent baker, not only because of the quality of the bread, but also because of that story and that relationship.
Chris Hartman's the founder and president of Headwater Food Hub. Online where?
Headwaterfoodhub.com.
And what are you eating tonight?
I don't know, but I have a feeling Vicky is going to make something beautiful, and my sister is in from out of town, and we're going to sit and enjoy it, whatever it is.
Thank you. Thanks for taking the time, and come back in and join us soon, because I know you're connected to the local food system in many ways that we didn't even get a chance to explore this hour, but we really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Evan. I appreciate it.
Chris Hartman, president and founder, Headwater Food Hub, every Thursday at 1 p.m. This summer is the summer of food. Hope you're enjoying these conversations as much as we are. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a lovely afternoon, and we're back with you Friday on member-supported public radio.